McGuire. Mr. Tassett, good morning to you. You may.
Morning. May it please the court. District Court properly convened an evidentiary hearing on Charlie McGuire's motion to return his seized property and clearly had jurisdiction to do so and to rule on it, but erred by denying Charlie's motion in part. Specifically, the District Court abused its discretion by requiring evidence that Charlie's had exclusive possession of his firearms at the time that they were seized before the items could be returned to him after the evidentiary hearing. What happened in the case, by way of background, is that there was a search warrant that was executed on Mr. McGuire's residence that he shared with three or four other guys, depending upon, at this particular time, it was about four other people.
How much of what you're now talking about is in the record that we have in this case?
Everything so far, Your Honor.
Do we have the search warrant?
We don't have the search warrant, no.
Do we have the affidavit for warrant?
We have test. What happened, Judge, is there was an evidentiary hearing where one of the officers who participated in the execution of the warrant testified.
I've read all of those pages.
Okay.
We don't have the warrant. We don't have the affidavit.
No.
We don't have, I don't recall there being testimony that it was Mr. McGuire's house. I mean, he lived there, but I don't recall there being evidence in that bill of exceptions of his ownership of the house.
Well, he did not own the house, Your Honor.
Okay.
He was a renter, as I was explaining previously. He rented the house pursuant to a lease with some other people.
Is that in our record?
Yes.
The renting relationship?
Yes.
Okay, I'll look
again. It's in the bill
again.
Of exceptions, Judge. As I was saying before, the issues that the judge decided, and there wasn't any question raised by the state about Mr. McGuire actually residing in the house. There was testimony in the record that Mr. McGuire's bedroom, where he lived, was inside this house. And that's where the items that I'm seeking the return of were largely found, in the bedroom and in the area of the bedroom. The problem in the case that we had is that the judge, I think, misapprehended the nature of the burden of proof that needed to be carried by the state in the case.
Didn't the judge order return of the property that was in the bedroom?
He did. His order specifically said that he would order the return of the property that was found inside the bedroom and around the bedroom, is what his order says. But what the order also says is that because the other property that I sought the return of in the motion was not in the exclusive possession of Mr. McGuire at the time that the search warrant occurred, at the time the search warrant was executed, that the judge decided that he would not be returning that property to Mr. McGuire. Specifically, that property consisted of some firearms and some ammunition. And those are the specific items that are identified in the motion with particularity, with reference to the search warrant inventory, that we're seeking the return of today. And the reason that I think that they should be returned, and the reason that I contend that the district court had erred when it disposed of the motion that I filed, is because the judge had no, the state did not prove to the judge that there was a legitimate interest of the state that would justify the retention of that property by the state. There was no evidence of superior title to the firearms that was adduced by the state during the evidentiary hearing, although they tried. And there was no other basis that can be found in the statute or in other law that justifies the state holding on to this property. As a practical matter, what happened at the hearing is, at the outset of the hearing, I called Mr. McGuire, the owner of this property, as a witness, and I asked him to swear to the truth of the allegations that he made in the motion, and he did so. And I didn't ask him any other questions following that, and the state declined to cross-examine him, even after the district court's invitation for them to do so. What happened then, as the court knows from reviewing the bill of exceptions, is that the state called the one of the officers who participated in the execution of the warrant. And the purpose the state had in calling the other officer, or the officer who participated in the execution of the warrant, the reason he was called as a witness is to try to convince the judge that these firearms should be retained by the state because they were either A, used in the commission of a crime, or B, that the state could prove some superior ownership interest to Mr. McGuire's ownership interest.
And that was where the E-Trace testimony.
The E-Trace testimony came in, and Your Honor, I described the state's presentation regarding the E-Trace testimony as equivocal. I think that that is accurate. Essentially, what the E-Trace evidence was, to the extent that it was admitted during the course of the hearing, was that the officer didn't know whether Mr. McGuire owned these guns or not, based on the E-Trace. E-Trace, as we found out from the evidentiary hearing, is a system whereby the ATF can record the last registered owner of a particular firearm, but the E-Trace system does not evidence or record or show private party sales. So I could be the owner of a firearm and sell it to someone else outside of any sort of regulatory authority or setup, and there would be no evidence or record or indication in the E-Trace system that that transaction had occurred. And so the deputy admitted that a few times during the course of the hearing until I was satisfied that the record was clear, that there really wasn't any dispute about the nature of the evidence that they tried to adduce. So what we have here is a situation where the judge, and I can't speak for him, I've read his order many times, it's a little cryptic insofar as its reasoning is concerned. The judge, I believe, was dissatisfied and was not willing to return the guns because the judge found that I did not show that these guns were in Mr. McGuire's exclusive possession at the time that they kicked the door in early in the morning on a random day when no one knew that they were coming. And I suggest in my brief and here again this morning that that standard is not correctly applied in this case, and that Mr. McGuire's sworn testimony, which was unchallenged by anybody at the hearing, despite a reasonable and ample opportunity to do so, my evidence of title was far superior to anything adduced by the state. I'd like to reserve a couple of minutes for rebuttal, if that's okay. Are there questions for me at this time regarding that? There is a jurisdictional issue in the case that I would expect the state to perhaps speak to, that I'd like to respond to once their arguments are made.
Thank you. Ms. Vincent, good morning to you.
May it please the court, my name is Melissa Vincent. I'm an assistant attorney general and I represent the appellee, the state of Nebraska. There are two issues presented by this appeal. Whether the district court had jurisdiction to rule on McGuire's motion for return of seized property, and if so, whether the court abused its discretion in denying McGuire's motion in part. I'll address the jurisdictional claim first. Preliminarily, I note that the state raised the issue below by a motion to dismiss, by written objection, and again orally at the hearing. Defense counsel took no position, and the district court denied the motion to dismiss without explanation. So in a very real sense, the state is in the same position on appeal that it was at the outset of the hearing. Now, the state's argument here is fairly straightforward. It's based on both the plain language and the history of Section 29-820. When the seized property statutes were initially enacted in 1963, the legislature vested the court with exclusive jurisdiction over seized property and further required that all seized property be disposed of by court order. That system later proved unworkable, and in 1986, and at the behest of law enforcement, the legislature amended Section 820 to vest law enforcement agencies with the authority to dispose of certain types of seized property without a court order, including firearms used in the commission of crime, which incidentally are characterized as contraband or treated like contraband.
At the point that we're talking about, the property had not been disposed of by law enforcement, correct?
That is correct.
Yes. So the court's jurisdiction, to the extent it had jurisdiction, had been invoked at that time, right?
Well, yeah, I guess arguably that's
and
true.
Is it your read of the statutes and the history that the legislature intended to take away jurisdiction from the court or simply to assist courts by not requiring courts to assert jurisdiction in particular instances?
Well, in all honesty, that was the struggle that I had in this case. When I was trying to reconcile the provisions in 818 and 820, I was looking at that language, and I'm like, okay, well, we have the grant of exclusive jurisdiction, and that applies to disposition language in that statute as well. That statute has remained, with the exception of the last sentence, has remained largely unchanged since they were enacted in 1963, but then you have two subsequent amendments to 820, which comes two sections later. And there you have them saying, okay, well, you know, once it's no longer needed as evidence, which we're under the disposition statute, then it gives, it seems to divide up the authority for disposing of property between the law enforcement agency and the court. And it gives the law enforcement agency the authority, based on a showing deemed adequate to the law enforcement agency, to dispose of certain categories of property, and then it leaves certain things to the district court, and then there's a catch-all provision, of course, under subsection 4.
But you're reading that as depriving the court of jurisdiction as opposed to supplementing its jurisdiction.
That's correct, and it's based on that canon of statutory construction where if you have, you know, two statutes that purport to govern the same subject matter, then the specific controls the general, and I would submit to you this section, or subsection 820, or section 820, excuse me, is far more specific than 818.
Is that consistent with the legislative history?
Well, it's hard to tell because I did, 1986, I thought was the most telling. When I read the legislative history there, they had Alan Curtis from the Lincoln Police Department come in and testify, and he was talking about the struggles that they were having disposing of seized property. They couldn't get court orders, and they were trying, and they were just sitting on all of these, you know, warehousing this evidence, essentially. But even before then, before the statute allowed them to dispose of firearms that were used in the commission of crime, which again are treated like contraband, apparently they had been doing that all along. And so when they amended the statute in 1986, they specifically put that provision in there. And they made it, they left the determination to the law enforcement agency to make. And so it seemed to me that it was supplanting or at least curbing the court's jurisdiction to dispose of seized
property.
Suppose
we disagree with that contention. Where does that take us?
That takes us to the merits.
Okay.
I mean, if the court has jurisdiction, then that takes us to the merits. And if you'd like me to go there, I certainly
maybe
can.
Maybe it would be a good idea.
Okay. if the court disagrees that the district court did in fact, and that the district court did in fact have jurisdiction, we submit the court to not abuse its discretion by denying McGuire's motion in part. It appears from the district court's disposition of the property that it followed the framework established by this court in Agee. The district court held a hearing at which the evidence was adduced for those items that were found in his exclusive possession, meaning they were in the bedroom. The court found that he was entitled to a presumption of ownership and that the state failed to rebut that presumption. However, with respect to the items that were not in his exclusive possession and for which there was no presumption of ownership, the court refused to return those items. And we submit that finding is supported by the evidence. Notably, none of the firearms were registered to McGuire, and two of those firearms were found in another resident's bedroom, meaning that they were in someone else's exclusive possession.
I'd like your assistance with how you read Agee. Agee talks about the property being seized from a person.
Yes.
And also at some other point talks about exclusive possession. Where does the exclusivity fit in the analytical framework? You're suggesting, I take it, and I want to be clear about this, that it's at the outset, that it has to be seized from my exclusive possession. Is that what I'm reading into your argument?
You are, and the reason I say that is because I think exclusive possession is a term of art. There are various kinds of possession. As the court well knows, you've got actual and constructive, you've got exclusive and joint. And the issue I have, I think the exclusive possession means just that. And if you look at the underlying facts of the Agee case, all of the evidence that was seized in that case was seized from a bedroom that was occupied by Agee. And then you have the Court of Appeals decision in Dubray, where I read that opinion to essentially read the exclusive possession language out of it and essentially expand it to the point where you are presumed to own the property that is seized in connection with your case, regardless of where it's found or who it owns it. And it just seems to me that awarding a presumption of ownership to somebody on a piece of property that never belonged to them in the first place, you know, I question the value of doing it, especially in Dubray. If you look at the facts in Dubray, you know, they shared a residence, he murders her, then he claims, you know, ownership of her property, And then, you know, the court says, well, okay, you're entitled to a presumption, so we essentially reward him with a presumption of ownership over her property, and then the state has to haul a witness into court to prove what should be obvious to everyone, which is that person and this woman's jewelry doesn't belong to that man. And I think it becomes, you know, it didn't make a lot of sense to me then, and it makes even less sense to me under these circumstances where you have a situation where you've got a drug manufacturing operation allegedly occurring in this residence, you've got several people who live there, and then you have a search warrant that's executed on the residence, and I don't know this for sure because the record's so scant here, but I can't imagine that he didn't have, that some of his roommates were not also charged. And so if you're going to apply...
But that's not in our record.
No, it's not.
And in fact, what they talked about, the conviction, wasn't necessarily a drug trafficking conviction at all, was it?
Not trafficking, it was possession. But I disagree with the court's finding in that regard. The order says something about, well, the state failed to prove that he was involved in distribution or what have you. And I realize that there's some of the officer's testimony would support that assertion. But, you know, just because charges, I'm not sure that conviction should be the litmus test with regard to some of these items, because it hamstrings plea bargaining for one thing. I mean, you can have somebody who commits an armed robbery, and the state charges them with robbery and use. There's really no dispute as to whether the firearm was used in the commission of the crime. But as a result of the plea bargain, he pleads to the robbery, the state dismisses the use, and now all of a sudden we have to return that property to him because, well, we don't have a conviction to support the use, I mean, you know, to support the firearm. So, you know, I'm not sure that, you know, the conviction should be...
What's your view about the analytical framework regarding the common areas? Does someone have to establish exclusive possession over items that were found in common areas?
Well, see, and that's the point, I guess, that I was trying to make with the exclusive possession earlier, is when you have a situation like this, and let's just assume hypothetically that some of his roommates were also charged in connection with this investigation. Presumably, if you use the Dubray iteration of this rule, then everybody in that house who was charged could lay claim to the very same property and be entitled to the very same, you know, the very same presumption of ownership. And I think that becomes problematic in a case like mine, or like this one here, where you potentially have a drug operation or something going on, and then you get into, you know, issues. I mean, so what does the state's burden become at that point? I mean, do we have to depose all of these people? Do we have to go get affidavits? Is it our business? You know, is it our job to sort that out? Because really,
what's the burden on the defendant, or in this case, the appellant?
In this case, mm-hmm. I think he could have simply gotten the rest of his roommates to, you know, either come into court or submit affidavits disowning, you know, disclaiming those properties that were, or those property that was jointly possessed as opposed to exclusive. But I mean, that's how I read AG. And like I said, I think exclusive possession is a term of art, and maybe I'm reading too strictly. Maybe the court didn't mean it in that sense, and maybe it really is the, you know, once something has been seized in connection with your case, it's presumed to be yours, but I just think that creates difficulties, even factually, in cases like Dubray, and certainly in a case like this, where you may have co-defendants who can all have the same claim to the same property.
Might create a rush to the courthouse after.
Exactly, and if you're a prosecutor, I guess maybe in some cases, like, well, first come, first serve, and if you want to come in later and say that it was yours, like, well, go see your buddy Charlie, because we gave it to him.
Or so. The agency will just do something.
What's that?
So, or the agency will just do something, foreclose the issue.
Yeah, possibly. So, anyway, I see that I'm out of time. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we indeed have time for rebuttal?
Yes, 2 minutes.
2 minutes and 58 seconds. Mr. Tassett, you may.
Counsel's suggesting that I should have called the roommates to come testify that the guns didn't belong to them. The fact of the matter is, the law's clear. I bore no burden at the hearing. And the exclusive possession simply confers a presumption on the claimant that it's his property. It doesn't mean anything other than that. The state's task at a hearing like the one that was convened in this case is to rebut the presumption. The cases are clear. AG, Dubray, Butter case, all of them say the same thing, and they have for years. The state bears the burden to explain and justify to the court why the property should be retained by the state.
Let me make sure that I'm understanding. You are not agreeing with the state that exclusive possession is the threshold showing that must be made, are you?
No.
All right.
It's to gain the presumption, according to a blended reading of Dubray with AG, and Dubray, the holding that I'm referring to is a court of appeals case, but to the extent that the presumption needs to be explained, I believe the presumption can be gained simply by claiming ownership of the property. It doesn't even have to be in the exclusive possession of the claimant. That's in the state's brief. They concede that in their brief. I went above and beyond that in this case by calling the claimant, Charles McGuire, to testify under oath that the property belonged to him. I have the presumption working for me. It's happening for me, but I also have the evidence, the positive, unchallenged, unrefuted evidence coming from the claimant that this property belongs to him. I don't have the burden and did not bear the burden at the hearing under this court's cases and under common understanding of how these motions should be adjudicated to bring anyone else to court to present at the evidentiary hearing. It's their job. If they thought that someone else had a superior claim of title or right to this property, then it's their duty to prove it. And again, I have the presumption and also the positive evidence on my side. So for them to suggest that I should have brought the other folks into court, which I would have done had these court had this court's cases told me that I needed to do, I would have brought them. I didn't have to, and I didn't do it. With respect to the jurisdictional argument, I know that it's been raised, and I was somewhat surprised that it was. In order to sustain the state's position on the jurisdictional aspect of this case, someone, one of the judges on this court, is going to have to author an opinion saying to our fellow Nebraskans that law enforcement can seize our firearms and keep them and destroy them without the citizen's recourse to the courts to challenge whatever decision has been made. That opinion cannot be written consistently with the constitutional provisions that are longstanding and commonly understood and closely guarded. So I don't believe that the state's jurisdictional argument should be sanctioned at all, and I think that the court should find that the district court had jurisdiction in this case and that the district court simply erred and abused its discretion by not returning all of the property to Mr. McGuire.
Thank you.
I have nothing else. Thank you. I have excuse.
Thank you very much. You are excused. The next case of the